listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API. Now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez. And before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Bobby Osinski.
Hello, Mike.
Hey, Bobby. Good to see you.
Likewise.
Next to him, we've got Scott Gershon.
Good morning, Mike.
Wow, Scott.
I don't know.
That's all I got.
It's only 8 p.m.
That's all relative, you know.
And next to him, we've got Diego Stucco.
Hey, Mike. How's it going?
Good. How are you, Diego?
Doing great. Thanks.
And finally, we've got the one and only Iron Man of the Audio Nowcast, Rob. This is my show. Wait, this is my 103rd show.
Wow.
Arbiter.
Hello, Mike. Is that really what it is?
Yes.
103.
We should just call Rob.
Well, and I just got off a plane last night, so I'm a little jet lagged. So we'll see how this goes.
And I used Iron Man because it's pretty appropriate, because our guest today is Tina Guo.
Hello.
Did I say that right, Tina?
Yes, you said it right. Guo.
Tina is an amazing cellist, and she's been featured on a ton of soundtracks. And to name a few, Sherlock Holmes, mm-hmm. Iron Man 2,
nice.
Clash of the Titans, and Inception.
Very
so,
cool.
Tina.
Yes.
Welcome. All those independent
Thank
films.
You. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really? Little ones. I didn't want to brag.
I asked her for some major titles, but that's all we could come
oh,
up
sorry.
With.
Sorry.
Also joining us for the show today, we have Michael Bard.
Hi, Mike. Nice to see you again.
Good to see you again. And Rob and Michael are working on a thing or two, and so...
Yeah, we'll talk about it
we'll
later
talk
in
about
the podcast.
A little bit later. But let's start right off the bat. NAB. How many guys went to NAB?
I was there.
I wasn't.
Somebody's got to work.
I was going to say...
Keep the lights on, right?
Tina, were you at NAB?
I have no idea what that is.
Good for you, though.
You must have enjoyed it.
And Bobby, were you there?
This is the first one I haven't gone in maybe 20 years.
Wow.
Is there still working. Audio at NAB?
There is. Yeah. It's actually really big.
National yeah. Association of Broadcasters.
Yeah, right.
Broadcasters.
It's grown back from...
Basically, audio people have
shrunken
and video and...
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy.
It's basically all the broadcasters get together in all the different disciplines, from video to audio to storage to tape decks and things like that.
And content was a really big thing.
Right.
3D. That's all I kept hearing about. It was everything was 3D.
Yeah.
No tape anymore, though.
What? Yeah, that's the one thing.
The 3D analog tape.
No.
I always want to be right then.
A few things on NAB is that I want to get to really quick is, number one, what Diego said is we're heading to a tapeless world, people, and it's going
heading?
Really fast. Well,
thought we're there.
No, because you still master on HDCam. HDCam SRs are, there's a ton of mastering on that, especially in broadcast. But with the Japanese, the earthquake over in Japan, as well as the tsunami, it's destroyed one of the factories, so you can't get HDCam SRs right now. So it was pretty timely with NAB, just seeing all the new... just technologies that were out there for solid state storage.
Yeah, it's all about new server technology, massive bandwidth, and
big pipes.
Yeah, I mean, because you're talking, you know, a uncompressed HD cam tape holds just a tremendous amount of data that you have. Not only do you have the uncompressed video, but you also have 12 channels of audio, and it's a great mastering format. But since you can't get the tapes, more and more there's studios that are going away from that. Already we do a lot of stuff at the studio that I work with. A couple studios, the tape is purely a backup. We feed everything with QuickTime files. But now, since it's kind of been pushed with the disaster over in Japan, it was amazing to see, you know, the tape cassette. But instead of a tape, inside was a little solid-state drive.
Yep.
You know, and that was... That was pretty amazing. But anything else really quick? Anybody see anything cool?
Well, I was there for work.
Right, and we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Yeah.
But Diego did a great thing on DTS, and I posted a little bit on the Facebook page, but he did the sound signature for DTS. But anything, Rob, did you see anything that you wanted to mention?
It wasn't... I didn't really go there searching for new technology. I basically try to go there every year because it's a great... meeting place where you know a lot of people are going to be congregating who you want to get in touch with. So I was there more for networking and meeting. I mean, it's nice to see new microphones, like Sanken had new mics. And it was nice to see some new products and new versions of software. But I was mostly there for the people. And it's a huge show. I think it's like the...
Yeah, isn't that nice?
And the gambling.
Well, I was there to try to get work out of them. So it wasn't really all that nice.
And he plays blackjack.
There was a little bit of that. Actually, more Pai Gow.
A little bit of Pai Gow
this time.
And Rob actually won this year.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
That's what made this year quite unusual, actually. But it's a great place to see people from all over the industry, because the joke there used to be that you could buy everything from a cassette tape to a satellite.
Right.
Because that show, it's massive. They have everything. And some of the booths, like Sony's booth, had it so big it had its own information booth within the booth to tell you how to find other things in the booth. I mean, it's like a city. Each of those big booths is like the size of a whole trade show for industries.
But the audio portion was like somebody's like...
No, well, it was much bigger.
It was much bigger.
There were
videos and computers.
Hey, little audio.
No, it was a pretty good swath of the North Hall.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of really cool new stuff. And, people were representing. It was good.
What was some of the new stuff?
Well, Rob mentions that new Sanken, they had a new like headset mic that was really wild sounding, really wild looking.
Sounded really good, and you barely see it.
God, I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. For Yamaha, the cards for Yamaha, a Yamaha digital mixer can interface with anything, like your toaster, right. Microwave, anything. I was amazed how many cards that they have.
Do people still use console?
But, live sound, and you figure churches, clubs, things like that.
Right.
Well,
and broadcast.
All
kinds of stuff. I'm a Digico kind of just.
That's one thing, is the broadcast desks that are out there. You may not see a lot of
unbelievable
a lot of
technology.
Desks for music, but for broadcast, it's like they're
fabulous.
All over. And I just want to know who buys these things. I mean,
they're very specific.
But that's just.
But there's a lot of them, and they look really cool. And they're companies that we never hear of in our industry. It's
never
really
strange. Heard of.
That's the thing. It was.
And
really
they're obviously big established companies. These are very expensive looking toys.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you the other thing about NAB that was really kind of cool is you see a lot of the mid-level DSLR range. You see a lot of gear for that. You see a lot of production kind of heading that way. You see smaller, better cameras. And it just means opportunities, because there's a lot of opportunities for people, because they're going to capture all these images. You're going to see a lot of production. You still got to deal with the audio. And it was really...
But they still have that scrappy little mic on top of the camera.
Yes, but that's just it. I mean, you can...
It's good for us.
It's good. There's room for careers in there. There's room for jobs. It's not going to be the one guy doing it all. Yes, there are going to be a couple guys like that can do everything. But
I saw two really cool things. One, along the lines that you're talking about, it was a company called New Tech, and they make something called TriCaster.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've been around.
And I know they've been around for a long time, but I was just like blown away by this thing. I mean, that's not even the business that I'm in.
Right.
But it was a virtual studio environment and a virtual switcher. And the stuff they were doing was flawlessly amazing.
Yeah, it's cheap, too. It's like $8,000 or something.
Yeah, well, depending on which one you get, for what it does, it's relatively cheap. I actually did an installation. I designed a small little studio for
Wait, was the guy that was changing backgrounds and stuff?
Yeah, he's changing the studio.
Oh, I saw it.
And all the all the shadows and stuff.
It's all built in,
And he was making himself bigger and smaller.
I saw that.
And it wasn't, it wasn't cheesy green screen.
No,
it was really...
And it was done there without any particular light or anything.
Exactly right.
You know what else was a big deal there that got a lot of attention was the Apple announcement about the next Final Cut studio.
Yes.
I was going to say, who was conspicuously absent?
Well, the story, I'm not sure I have all the details straight, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you guys know, but what I heard is that, because I didn't actually see the announcement, but I heard a lot of people talking about it, and it was that Final Cut Studio is now going to be $200.
$299.
$299. Okay. Yeah. And you're going to get it from the App Store. And I mean, it's getting cheap to the point where.
I just bought it for $850.
Well, yeah, a lot of people are going to be saying that.
Well, but on the flip side of that, the other thing that I heard about this announcement was that basically pro support was going away.
No, see, that's not true.
Good.
The problem with the message. Fill us in, Mike.
No, there's a lot of speculation. I actually know a little bit about Final Cut 10, but they're still going to support pro. They're really still committed to the pro market. It's a different looking product. It's a wild-looking product. It's basically combining a lot of the features that they have in iMovie and for grown-ups. You can call it iMovie for grown-ups.
Oh, I need to get it. I use iMovie.
We haven't seen the final version, but they're definitely still committed to pro market.
Final Cut 10 is light?
No, it's different. It's definitely different. It's easier, but it's really, it's different. That's about the best way I can say it, because they took away the preview window. You have a source monitor. You see if you ever used iMovie, you see the clip. All the information about that clip is actually on a little icon that shows the movies. You can scroll within that icon to get your place. Then you can do your edit, and it has a lot of features that are very different from the way that you're used to working now. You're either going to love it or you're going to hate it. So
I hate iMovie.
But I will say that they are still, I've heard that they're still committed to the pro market. And when it comes out, it should still be able to do OMFs and still be able to do most of the stuff that we're used to. Now, how it does that, I don't know. Because you can do compound clips, which is basically, sequences within the sequence, that type of stuff. But I don't know how that's going to relate to EDLs, which are important to sound guys, as well as OMFs, which are important to sound guys. So it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out. But they, it's still going to be considered a pro app, and they're still going to support the pro market. And we really haven't seen what's going to happen with the studio, because they still have the whole studio thing that they got to deal with as far as motion and color is actually going to be kind of folded into
so you color time it inside of
Inside Final Cut. So it's a lot of people are panicking. If you look on websites, it's like Apple's running, yada, and there's a lot of rumor out there. But your best bet is if you're using Final Cut 7 right now, just
use
stay
it.
On it and see what happens, and just wait until you get the release of Final Cut 10, and then see what happens.
Well, I will tell you that I sat through a long demo at Adobe of their CS 5.5 suite, which includes all of the stuff, including After Effects and
Premiere,
and the new Premiere, and the new Adobe Audition, which is phenomenal. It's phenomenal.
But it's Adobe. Adobe's like Microsoft, as far as I'm concerned.
Well,
there's always something that's crapping out, that's crashing. They have this incessant pop-ups that, there's a new version. There's something underlying that you have to add. And then supposedly 5.5 is going to a rental format as well, which everybody was really upset
really?
About. Yes, where you had to, it was basically a subscription. You didn't buy it, you subscribed to it. And people were going crazy in the various
Are they coming out with an oral exciter? Is that what this is all about?
But I think some of the Apple's trick is, which I think they did with Logic, is they go, hey, this great new app comes out, and it really needs to take advantage of the latest Apple hardware.
Yeah.
So what you do is you go, this is really great. You buy the new software, and both Rob and I did it, with Logic. So what do? You go out and buy a new Mac to support that new software. And reality is Mac's in the hardware business, not the software business. And they use it as a loss leader for you to buy another Mac.
Right.
I bought a new one. I have three now.
Yeah. See, it works with her.
Well, it works for me.
But even as silly as DigiDesign and Avid on native, they go, hey, you realize that if you had a 12 core, you could sit there and have like an HD 6 for the price of this. So everyone's, okay.
Do you use Logic?
Yes.
Okay. Bill, did you hear that?
See, we found the
he's not here, but he's going to love you forever.
A member of the panel was very pro Logic.
Okay.
Let me ask you, Tina, do you do any video editing? Do you do
In iMovie, I
you
do.
You do,
yes.
iMovie.
Mm-hmm.
See, it's more and more people are getting involved, and I think what
they're
doing
the Q3
is making...
Isn't the great, by the way?
It's amazing. It's an awesome product. We're actually being filmed on it right now. Everybody turn and look.
Oh, we are! I picked up a Q3
HD. I take
HD.
It everywhere. Oh, I don't have the HD one. I'm going to have to contact them.
But I'm waiting for the little stand and the little mic thing.
Oh. Yeah, it's great. I film all my concerts, everything on it. The light, you know, it's not very light sensitive, so that's not good. But the sound is amazing.
See, so I think Apple has it right.
It's
with
the Zoom, sorry.
Oh, Zoom.
Zoom.
Oh.
Sure, yeah. And it sounds really good. It
sounds very good.
I think Apple has it right with the Final Cut Pro 10, and they're just basically trying to elevate that at that market just a little bit, making it a little more approachable for people. And we'll see what happens. So stand by if you're getting worried about Final Cut and Apple and Pro Support.
I'm not worried. I'm a fanboy. I'll buy it.
Anyway. I know. Me too. It's also going to be. I mean, come on, $300. That's cheap.
Can't don't tell me.
But I will say, you know, I will say
$50 for the real.
Price. I know, but you. I will say, Michael. Though Adobe, though they did. You know, I hadn't used Adobe for a long time, and I recently just got CS5. I actually bought a real version, by the way, not cracked.
Wow.
And,
can we quote you on that?
Yes, you can. But,
so you don't want to edit that?
No, I got the real version.
Oh, okay.
And, but it does. It updates itself all the time, all so the you're time. Right. But, man, there is some power in those applications. That's all I can say. Like Premiere Pro has really turned into a cool thing. I mean, just the fact that you can play mix matched media and not have to render. I mean,
stuff that
Final Cut, you have to either use string clip and convert it, or you sit there for the render break.
And I heard in a conversation at NAB with someone whose opinion I respect, that Adobe was really eyeing and stepping into the pro market, where they could sense that Apple was kind of stepping out. I mean, the fact is, this is
why
my
did
opinion.
Apple step out? Yeah.
Well, this is my opinion. Apple makes so much more money from iPhones and iPads and apps than they do from the pro video market. So much more money. There's no.
It's just not worth it.
It's just not. Well,
wait, that's not true.
But you spin off the company into a.
No, wait. On last Tuesday, they had their profit report, and they made something like $3.8 billion just from Mac Pros.
Hardware.
Well, but they need
hardware, but
software to sell.
But
the
software to sell the hardware that you know people aren't buying a Mac Pro unless you're doing. Unless you're doing something that's pro on it.
Right. No, I don't disagree with that. But I guess I see the whole idea of Adobe stepping in as a real possibility.
I'm just glad that Adobe is given some competition. I want Adobe to be strong. I want Avid to be strong. And I want Apple to be strong. And I want those guys to duke it out all the time.
Triple A.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know? I want all those companies to do well because competition is only gonna just get more and more innovative features from the different companies as they go out. Especially like one app I'm really interested in using is the On Location, where you basically turn your computer into a video recorder, so I can run through whatever interface that I have, do my interviews and record straight into my computer and just bypass altogether any type of media other than my hard drive. And I think that's kind of cool, depending if you have an Aja box or whatever you have.
Right, the whole acquisition and then having to ingest it and all that.
Yeah, I've tried to use my laptop numerous times as a location recorder. You think, this is great. I got plugins. I can do all my mics in it.
Right.
And then there's a couple of realities. First of all, there's the sun.
Yeah.
A couple things the sun does.
Yeah.
First of all, I can't see my monitor.
Right.
So then you build the box. You put it in the box.
Yep.
And then, you know, of course, it's about 120 degrees outside. So then you watch literally in real time your battery indicator just go boom.
And your CPU going. Okay.
So then you think, okay, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to get a boat battery with an inverter and power the damn thing. Then you realize you're pretty much carrying around about 500 pounds.
Right.
Because you got a laptop, and it's really portable, you see.
That's really
And then, you know, because then you got your mic freeze and your mics, and you set it up. And then you realize, God, all I wish I had is a little high-end recorder.
I just want one of those sound devices things that records eight tracks.
Yeah, I sat there, and I said, this is really great. And I'm like, and we're recording. I'm like, wait a minute. I'm not sure if the plugin's working. wait a minute. So after all this, I'm like, wait a minute. Anyone have a battery?
Well, I will say though, Scott, when you say use it on location, when Scott says on location, he means on location.
Right.
We're talking like deserts, the moon, jungles, right. Africa.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's portable.
Like, when right? I say when I'm like when I shoot video, I'm talking, you know, controlled environment because I have my lights and it has
to be talking about electricity.
Exactly.
For him, location is moving to the next studio.
That's right.
Electricity and air conditioning.
Civilization.
And also, it's hard to run from lions when you're running with a laptop.
Yes. And the hard drives, you know, just that. You know.
So it's all that to say as we wrap up the NAB is, you know, there's a lot of great innovation going on. There's a lot of cool things coming out. And don't panic, Michael.
Okay. I'm not actually, you know, one thing I will say though, looking at the NAMM show and the trends of NAB, which is exciting on certain levels, and that is a lot of amazing technology is coming at us that's incredibly affordable.
Right.
Even for the professional and the semi-professional. So, you know, most of us are audio people. So to sit there and say, hey, you're going to, you know, shell out $5 to $10,000 to play with some video.
Right.
You aren't going to do it. But now we shell out $200 to $300.
Yeah,
sure.
And, yeah. And you see, for Tina and for me, yeah. It's an important part of what we do because we film, we put yeah. online our stuff.
It's huge. Now.
It's not just something that you do on your spare time. You actually consider part of what we do because it's important to mm-hmm. you know show people how we do things.
I think it's part of the new revolution yeah. of
oh yeah,
what's going to happen with definitely. Musicians.
I mean, yeah. I saw her first. On a video that she made.
Hans saw me on a video.
Yeah.
Yeah he showed me everybody your video. At the studio. They're right. like, we need to get you here. But it was through YouTube.
And the
you
same know, for
video.
Me.
Yeah, so, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's so sweet. Yeah. They're like YouTube babies.
I was born on YouTube.
I never thought about that way. Like, that's cute.
Yeah, so...
Well, I hate to bust your bubble, but so is Justin Bieber.
I hate to bust that bubble, so is Rebecca Black.
That's where we're heading now.
Going back to it, though, is, you know, it's great. We were, I'm working right now on Green Lantern, and right. I'm looking at all these, you know, how do I create the green sounds and all this stuff, and what am I doing, and how am I doing it?
Right.
And then someone says, hey, have you checked out the new blah, blah, granular synthesis online? And I went, no. How much is it? It's about $100. I said, do you like it? And they go, yeah. And I buy it. Because you can. It's only $100. Right. You know, before it was, and you just basically go to the website, you download it, you play with it, go, this is kind of cool. And you use it. And I find just the workflow is different now.
Well, the immediacy of being able to get a tool like yeah. that. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and just the fact that like you can do things not only on your computer, but like I'm a big advocate of the iPad, and you know I've done several commercials where all my design, everything has been on the iPad, and that's you know I don't think I have an application that I spent more than $10 on. Yeah. So it's just amazing.
Yeah, even the new GarageBand is great.
Yeah,
on the iPad.
On the iPad for yeah. what it is, yeah. it's yeah. a fun
it's
little
really,
sketchbook.
It's really good.
But the question is, though, I mean, I know Elisa's has come up with a new audio interface, which isn't out yet, but how do you interface it in a really high-quality way?
There are different ways, different hardware coming out. Now, I saw one at the NAMM show. It was Alesis, I think.
Yes, Alesis, yeah.
Yeah, and then there are multiple MIDI interfaces coming out.
Is there anything right now out?
Apogee did one, too,
Apogee
I think.
Has one. You know, I don't have a problem with going straight out of the iPad output. It's not that noisy, mm-hmm. and I go into a really nice mic pre.
But how do you interface know? With it?
Just I use a little headphone jack.
How do I input?
You've
got an audio in to do processing,
yeah.
uh-huh. or you need some form yeah. of interface.
I use an M-Audio Fast Track. Is that what you're talking about?
So it's got to go into the iPad.
It just goes directly USB into the computer.
To go into it too, you can get like.
Oh, so you have connected to your computer.
Yeah.
The iPad.
Or no, I'm talking about my laptop. I don't have an iPad yet. I'm sorry. Don't hate me.
No.
Okay.
Well, how do you go into your app?
Okay. Here's how I do it. Okay. I mainly use Curtis, which is
yeah.
a granular synth.
Yeah, yeah.
When I want to record, I just use the mic. That's right there because I'm going granular anyhow, so I just want to just distort it as much as I can and do crazy things with mm-hmm. it. And then I can hook up my keyboard. I have a little keyboard, and I hook it straight up into the multi-pin connector on the bottom mm-hmm. Through the camera connection kit. and that's how I can play it back. That's when I go, when I'm going to do anything recording. Okay, the synths that they have in there, like X-Synth and a couple other ones, I just come out of the little eighth inch output, just come straight in to eighth inch to quarter inch stereo, plug it into my
mic. How are you, is it using the pad for the keyboard itself, or?
See, here's the thing. The synths that I use are multi-touch, so you can actually use the screen. Like, you can see your waveform here, and then you can oscillate. You can set your parameters to however you want them. That's the cool thing about the iPad.
On GarageBand, they have the piano version. Mm-hmm. It even detects velocity.
Really?
Yes. That's a cool thing about it. You think it's just a toy, but, I mean, you cannot compare it to a real piano, okay? But for what it is, $5 or
something? Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Okay, and you have velocity on the piano inside the iPad.
Sure. No, I you know, it's like when we talk about the iPhone, like, well, I can control Pro Tools.
Right.
Like, it's too small.
Right, but you know.
So the question is, at what point? Though, it's fascinating, though, because on one point, it's a novel toy.
Yes, but they're also...
At some point, it gets beyond that.
This is what's happening now, because I see synths being developed specifically for the iPad, which wouldn't be developed for other platforms, and they are very, very cool, leaving aside the visual, which are very important in the iPad, but the sound they can make, they can be used for something.
Well, I like the idea that you could dock it into something.
Exactly.
At that point, all of a sudden...
Yeah.
But like, I'm trying in a pro use to say, how do I really make it part of my... arsenal, but well, I need ins and outs.
That's what I'm trying to figure out as well.
I just got a message that there's one called the Sound Devices USB Pre 2, which will work.
Sound devices?
Oh, right, they just come out there. Yeah.
Sound device, see?
I have tons of sound device stuff.
Yeah.
That works with an iPad?
Yep, works with an iPad.
Yeah, you see, once you have something like that, it's not a toy anymore.
But a sound devices is actually very, very
that's high end.
So, do you have the page there? Is it expensive?
This is the little voice that talks in my head while we record. This is actually coming from Jeremy in the other room.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks, Jeremy.
But
he's our dealer at this point. He's just going,
right.
Fix me up, man. Fix me up.
All right. Hey, before we go to our break, I also want to move and talk a little bit about what Diego was doing over there. I posted a little bit of on our Facebook page, but Diego did a really cool demonstration on how he did the sound design for DTS's new sound signature, and it was pretty cool, Diego.
Thanks.
I mean,
you did
a good job, and
I was actually very, very proud of that project first, because it was crazy. I could do all the craziest things. I want to show you the video, actually, Scott. I was golfing water balloons to create these massive explosions of water. And
nice.
Yeah, but just to make a little bit of context, I created the DTS sound signature. There's the video with these three hits, and I basically created this massive sound design thing and the music together, so it's a fusion of the two elements.
Nice.
And I was presenting there the process, the making of how I did everything. And I was at the Intel booth. And so they were there. I was basically breaking the... And now we're talking about solid-state drives, and people were going, and then it comes me with the golfing balloon thing, dropping lentils inside milk, and people go,
And then they played it back in 11.1.
Oh, yeah. No, yes, I think it was or either 7 or 11. I'm not sure about the format, but it was in surround.
Yeah, it was surround.
And it was very, very cool. And loud. I liked it because it was loud.
And there was a. Do you have that video posted on your website?
Right now, there's a very short clip on YouTube, but I'm posting a longer version with pictures and descriptions as soon as I find the time.
Right, yeah. And there'll also be. And Diego used a lot of API gear, so we're doing that.
Oh, yeah, you gotta hear the sound that I got from the milk. I boosted the 50 hertz, 12 dBs, and I was the microphone this close to the milk. By the way, company that sponsors me, I need more mic.
You got milk.
Right. I was recording.
What did you put in the milk?
Lentils and barley.
And barley?
Yes, and I was, you know, spinning them with a spoon, and it was making this. And I recorded with mics very close. So I got the real...
XY, so you get stereo.
Yes, okay. Massive stereo field and this huge organic sound that you hear. It's beautiful.
It's pretty cool. Well, we'll play it afterwards because it's pretty cool. We can show them.
Nice.
Diego did that. And so just be on the lookout for either on the API site or Diego's site for some videos of that, because it's pretty cool, the techniques that he used and everything. The big question is, How do you waterproof your microphones? Brandon wanted to know.
Wrapping paper.
Okay. That's, yeah. That's what I told him.
Yeah. There's wrapping, another technique.
Wrapping paper?
Yeah. Like plastic brown paper.
Saran wrap.
Oh, saran wrap.
Yeah.
Well, what I think some the big question is...
I know, but it didn't look nice on videos. And so I know...
To pay, you know.
Right, right. But it's like, imagine me... No.
Yeah.
So, wait, what are those other things?
No, please.
I think the big question is, why milk?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Milk?
Because I did first with water, but milk is more dense.
Yeah.
And so the when you drop milk inside... It makes a more kind of low, bubbly sound. And also the way it just grips with stuff. Water doesn't connect with other stuff. It was really like a soup at the end.
You should try next time, or let's try ice cream.
Ice cream? That's a good idea.
We used to do like ice cream farts. So you sit there and they go, you know, they just, because it's thick. And,
right.
Especially when it starts melting.
Yeah. Well, I think milk.
But milk's good, though. Milk is thicker,
yeah.
It worked. Oil. It worked really well.
Yeah, I like the expression of people looking, because I was telling people, well, this is what I usually do every morning. I mean, not the spinning stuff. Are you drinking milk? Yeah.
So you woke up one morning and said, milk!
That's milk! That's what I did, actually. The
cool thing about milk, though, is when he was dropping the lentils on it, there's a texture. You can hear, like, the texture of the lightness of the lentils.
Oh, yeah.
And the thickness of the milk. Yeah. And it sounds really cool.
And still, you know, it's the best way of creating sound effects, using real things, you know.
The best sound effects place is pretty much your house.
Right, exactly.
Whatever you have in the house... You can do amazing things
Exactly. And I was, you know, I got so close with the microphones.
Which mics did you use?
Rode
microphones.
I use Rode also.
Nice. Very nice.
I just chime in every 10,000 words.
did you use the little XY mic?
I used the NT5s.
Yeah. And did you find they were quiet enough?
Well, they are. I mean, the API gear is incredible.
Right.
I mean, the kind of sound that I was able to pick up with that is... I mean, this is something that it's important for people to know. When you're using a cheap or kind of affordable preamp, when you crank up the settings, there it's when you start to hear all the bad things happening, you know, the noises, interference, and things. With the API, you go full scale,
it's great
and it
way.
Sounds transparent. And of course, if you want to make it colored, you just crank up the settings and everything. So
but API kind of has like no color, but massive amounts of gain.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Well, on that note...
I actually didn't use any denoising on anything, really.
Well, that's great. Well, we're going to take a break right now. And then when we come back, we're going to visit with Tina a little bit and get to something you know a little bit about.
I think Lady Gaga would like the milk.
Oh, yeah, great.
Well, I was going to ask Tina if she put the cello in the milk.
I think
this is the beginning of a Got Milk commercial.
Yes. And everybody get wrapped with plastic paper.
Yeah. All right, well, we're going to take a break, so we'll see you on the other side.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to Gabby Nowcast. And before the break, we were talking about how awesome milk is. So joining us today, we have Tina
Guo. Like,
whoa.
I spelled it out phonetically. Guo. And
you still didn't get it? How did you do it?
I couldn't spell my writing.
Oh, come on. Guo. No Tina. Coffee. Can't say my name.
I know.
I think I have to go now.
But you're in Hollywood here, you know?
And let me just tell you, right now, you should, if you're listening to this, you should go to Tina Woes, see, I said it right, to her website because has worked on some amazing stuff. She's worked on some great stuff, has some great pictures on there.
And what is her website?
How many pictures?
TinaGuo.com.
Spelled?
Spelled G-U-O. for Guo. Tina is T-I-N-A.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your background and how long you've been playing and where you studied. And
I was born in China, in Shanghai. I moved out when I was 5. I went to USC for classical cello performance. I crossed over into doing like metal and fusion electric cello a couple years into college, freaked everybody out.
That's awesome.
That's the way to go. Baby.
I left school after 3 years because my performance schedule got really full and busy. And then somehow I got wrangled into doing music for video games and filmed completely by accident. You know, I never meant to do it.
Right.
So now my career is kind of, I write music. I have a band, like a fusion metal band. I play jazz fusion. I play on film, TV, video game scores.
What's the name of your band?
It's actually a new thing that I'm doing. It's actually just my name right now.
I gotcha.
But it's, we're working on something special. So.
And so tell us about your live rig, especially with your cello, your electric cello.
I have my own company. I used to be with Yamaha,
right.
And they're an awesome company. I really appreciate everything that they've done for me. But I'm now working with a new company. It's called Cambiar, and it's a small boutique company based in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Every instrument is handmade. Mm-hmm. The quality of the wood and the carbon fiber, everything that we're fabricating the instruments from are super high-tech. We have some very interesting technical aspects of the instruments that have never been used on a musical instrument before, like a suspendable bridge that you can actually lower and heighten depending on how...
Nice.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know how they made it. It was just, I throw out ideas and they make it happen.
Bring the tension of the string down before you move it?
I'm not quite sure. This is the newest prototype that we're working on.
Okay.
But so it's going to be available probably in a couple months. So we've been sending the instrument back and forth for like 4 or 5 times already.
It's a whammy bar for you know.
Well, that's pretty cool. Have you used any of the like the Eigenharp or any of the alternate controllers that are kind of cello looking? I don't know if you've seen.
No.
If you're familiar with that.
No, I haven't.
It's pretty wild. Yeah.
Yeah, it's basically just a giant neck with a bunch of
stuff.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to explain it.
That's
so weird. Yeah.
The Eigenharp?
I mean, come on. I mean, she's what she does with the electric
cello. No, I know. I was just curious if she's ever used it.
You know what you should try?
What should I try?
The K-Bow from Keith McMillan. It's basically a bow
mm-hmm.
that detects
uh-huh.
the movement that sends MIDI signal out
mm-hmm.
so you can control stuff via MIDI
uh-huh.
with the bow.
Very cool.
And it's very, very sophisticated. And it's incredible.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm going to put you guys in contact.
Good, thank you.
Yes.
So what type of processing do you do with...
Well, with my electric cello rig,
yep.
I usually go through a guitar amp.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have like a pedal board, like any guitar player. Basically,
right.
electric cello is just like a guitar, except
right.
you use a bow, you know, and it looks a little different.
And you look wilder, though.
And, I you know, maybe I go a little crazy, like lose
She's
control.
Just
but...
Have you checked out Axe FX?
No. What is that?
Ooh.
Ooh, that's it.
From Scott, that's a lot.
Scott never talks.
I know. We can talk later about it. But no, mm-hmm. it's a guitar simulator. It's an amp simulator.
Uh-huh.
But it's super high end
uh-huh.
using Shark cards. Have we talked about this before? Okay. It's about 100 amps, 12 mics, 20 cabinets, and 100 boutique pedals.
Wow.
So they got like multi-band delays.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the ultimate guitar player rig.
Uh-huh.
So you can have all the different amps, everything from Boogies to Marshalls to Jazz Rollin' Chorus.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the 11, but way like on steroids.
Does it work on the iPad?
I mean, I have like a GT8, you know, but that's not really, I'm sure it's not as complex
as
what...
It's an amp simulator. So you can, whatever
amp
you
simulator,
put for
okay.
it, guitar, bass, acoustic.
That I could use, you know, because sometimes I might have a very large car, you
right.
know, when I pulled up, they were intimidated,
yes.
but I'm a small girl and I'm, you know, a small Asian girl, so I can't carry a huge amp by myself unless I hire people. So a lot of times I'll just go direct. So that would definitely be
and it has,
something that would...
outputs mm-hmm. for speakers as well as
mm-hmm.
outputs directly to the studio.
Uh-huh.
So you can do it to the one to the console and one to your monitor section.
Cool. Yeah.
So, and with a full pedal board.
Okay, nice. Like, as far as a pedal board, I might be old school, if that makes any sense, but I really like organic pedals. I don't like to use...
You like the separate ones?
Yeah,
the,
I like,
the,
like
the
nice.
Just everyone has its own individual sound, you know, you kick it a few times, give it a little...
a little love on stage.
Right.
Well, you know, one thing I wanted to talk about, and it's great that you're here, Tina, is I wanted to talk about the classical instruments, because there seems to be, especially you know in California, you know, music education is just getting attacked, and there's a lot of schools that are basically getting rid of a lot of the early music education. Like down where my kids go to school, around fifth grade, all the fifth graders used to have to play the violin, but they no longer do that. Things like that, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about classical instruments and their, you know, how relative they are, how necessary they are, especially in the digital age. I mean, what are you guys' opinions of that as you see things? And being a cellist, mm-hmm. Are you worried that they're starting to lose the perception of being, you know, relevant in today's music? Even though, if anything, I think they're more so because of the expressiveness that you can get out of a...
You're talking about specifically classical string instruments?
I
don't think string instruments were ever considered mainstream or cool, you know, if that's right. really what you're referring to. So.
No, it's not even so much that they were, because you're right, they were never considered cool.
No, I was like
but
the total
But kids had, at least they were, they had the opportunity to learn them. Mm-hmm. And it just seems more and more, you know, they're getting squeezed. And they're, mm-hmm. you know, when a kid's going to learn music nowadays, is he going to pick up GarageBand or is he going to go pick up a real instrument? I'm not even talking to, you know, we can expand it to the trumpet, to the saxophone. You know, mm-hmm. It just seems like there's this attack, not attack, but there's this.
But did you hear about in the news that the Philadelphia Orchestra is going bankrupt?
Oh, yeah, I read about that too.
And it's a big deal. So what they're finding is that the average, which I think is great actually with what you're doing, because you're modernizing something that was considered old. Or something that is not relatable to the next set of generations.
Exactly.
And a lot of people they're finding don't go, I can maybe see a pop concert, a rock concert, or maybe I'll just go see a classical concert.
I have, I'm sorry to cut you off, but example. I had a tour in Italy in January, and I had like some of my fans of my metal stuff come to my classical concerto performances to see the Saint-Saëns concerto, you know? Mm-hmm. And usually that would never happen. You know, so I think it's a good thing for, I don't know, maybe I'm getting kind of philosophical now, but I think it's good to always go with the flow, you know, and not to fight things. And I think as people, we like to get attached to things, you know, right. whether they're our ideas or our feelings or just things are the way that they are, but things will always change, you know, so I think we should flow.
But it really depends on what resonates mm-hmm. with the generation, because I hate to admit it, but when I finally went to music school and I started learning all of the great composers, all I kept thinking was Bugs Bunny, because I heard all of this music on Bugs Bunny cartoons, because as a youngster, I didn't sit there and go, hey, Dad, I want to hear the classical album again and really be able to appreciate that.
Right.
And and the thing was, like, every time I kept hearing, oh, this is Vivaldi, this is, you know, Beethoven, this is all these different people, I kept thinking, oh, my God, this is where the rabbit jumps out of the hole and Elmer J. Fudd comes. And I could hear it all, and it's what you relate to, and I think it's great as people that have had more traditional instruments, mm-hmm. especially orchestral style instruments, that are using them like in heavy metal or things that are breaking out of that genre. I think all of a sudden, people open up people going, what is that? That's really cool. And then they expand and branch into all of these other things.
But you know what? Just because you mentioned the iPad, the threshold before being able to extract something musical out of a cello, it's way higher than an iPad. Way higher. Yeah. You have to spend years in learning the positions before you actually enjoy and people around you enjoy what you're trying to do.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
In these days, the satisfaction, the immediate satisfaction that you can get out of an iPad, you can't compare with a cello.
But I think it's a much bigger thing than just classical music versus
organic
today.
Music in general.
It's organic music in
general.
For example, it's acoustic music playing traditional instruments where you have to actually train.
Yeah, but for example, an instrument is traditional only if you keep it in a traditional sense. The way she plays the cello, it's not traditional, but it's current and it's beautiful because
I also do traditional.
Oh, I know.
She couldn't do all of the cool mind-blowing stuff that she does unless she knew how to play the cello.
But the question is, what inspires you? Because when I remember being a kid, between Jean-Luc Ponty and the violinist from Kansas, mm-hmm. and when I first heard it, I thought, wow, a violin in a rock band.
Right.
Who would have thought in those days, you know, our flautist with Jeff Rotol. I mean, you can sit there. Oh, yeah. You know, so then you can look at all the different things that will inspire somebody
but
to go.
But I'm sure that many people picked up the flute because of Jet Rotol.
I
was playing in a band with a friend of mine. He started because of Jet Rotol.
Yeah.
Bobby, were you going to say something? Or?
Last week I had dinner with an old friend. And he owns the biggest sound company in Europe now. It's called SSE. And they do most of the major festivals, and U2's one of their clients, Metallica. And just to show you the scope of how big they are, they have 4,000 microphones in their inventory.
Wow.
And we're discussing, you know, the festivals that he does. And I said, well, how many raves and things like that do you do? And he says, well, not that many, because the trend in Europe now is back to real music and real musicians.
Hmm.
And he was saying that organic music has come back so far that that's all they see anymore. And now this is someone who's very plugged into the scene because right. that's what they do.
It's his livelihood.
Now, I think what will happen is we may see that 2 or 3 years over here because we're always lagging behind Europe. But I thought it was a great sign that, in fact, yeah. something like that was happening. That trend was starting
to occur. And as a musician, I see it happening every day. I see more gigs opening up, more opportunities opening up, and I see more of my friends working, and I see just more, you know, more call. People are finally sort of waking up to that whole human connection.
Oh, yeah. And also, I mean, and this is something that you don't really know if you haven't played an acoustic instrument before, but when you sit in front of a piano, it's so beautiful. The vibration, they interact with your body. And it's the same thing when you play the cello. I mean, you feel the instrument.
Right.
So you have the pleasure of playing and the pleasure of receiving. It's an exchange with your instrument.
Yeah.
But that's what electronic instruments have always been trying to, have always tried to emulate. Was the expressiveness of an acoustic instrument.
Right. right. But
can almost get there.
But once you know, you guys playing a laptop computer, the DJ, you know, it's like...
Yeah.
And after a while, you sit there and you go, I'm just bored.
Well...
Visually, I mean, unless it's a multimedia show. Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. And I'm a huge electronic music fan. I mean, I love electronic music, but there is nothing more boring than looking at
checking emails.
DJ doing his thing with just looking at his laptop screen.
I mean, in fact, the most successful DJs, when I was at NAB, a taxi driver, are you Tiesto? I said, no, I'm not him. But he was asking me a lot of questions. Yeah. And he was, is he really the biggest? I don't know. I said, and he said, how come that he became so big? Well, because he makes a show. It's not really about connecting two records together. Right. It's about everything that is around.
And he bops his head just a little different.
Yeah, yes. You know? That makes sense.
You got the guys that go around. You got the guys that go forward. And
right.
But I think it's an issue with people doing...
I wish we would have a camera right now. We have a camera.
Yeah, right.
But the people doing classical instruments, I mean, even I saw the Foo Fighters concert, and they had a cellist.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh,
again,
right. Yeah,
so then, you know, and I'm seeing it more and more where people from... not just like the brass players from the old Motown days, but now you start to see string players. You know, everything from the old days of Alanis Morissette to Foo Fighters to... You see, it's almost becoming very common to have a small string section as well as people coming out as soloists.
Jeff Beck, last tour.
Jamiroquai, since the beginning, they had a little string section with them. It was so cool at the time.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, when we asked the question at the early, you know, at the beginning of the segment, why strings still matter. And I think the reason why they still matter is because of the feel and of the emotion. And I think as long as people want feeling and emotion in their music, there's always going to be a place.
But there's another thing, too. If you look at the five arrangement elements, being the foundation, which is usually bass and drums, a rhythm instrument, which is usually pushes the motion, which is double the pulse of the beat, and the lead and the fills, you have the pad, whatever plays the pad. And what's better than strings for that pad to glue everything together? You know, so it's either that or a Hammond B3 or a Rhodes or something.
That's fun.
but I would imagine, you know, because I've been like heavily getting into the guitar back again and hearing things growl. I love growling. And I know a cello, you know, you put distortion on and you know, I'm thinking even from sound effect side.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I mean, so many just great.
Yeah, I've done.
So if you sit there, you put through a big speaker and you're.
Mm-hmm. In Omnisphere, I did some sounds with a cello.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I made them sound like dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Of course, dinosaurs that I imagined. Yeah. But it's so cool.
It moves. It gives you that emotional. Yeah.
Wow. You know, another thing that I want to comment on is when you look at. If you either play an instrument or you look at somebody who plays an instrument, there's a connection that you have when you play that instrument that is a bond that's unlike anything else. It's just you get to be able to like channel your emotion, you know, into this piece of wood or this, you know, brass or whatever. I mean, it's just, it gets really emotional and you get really close. I mean, for instance, how do you feel when you're playing your cello? I mean, what?
I think, you know, just because you play, let me first say that just because you play a musical instrument doesn't make you an artist.
Right.
You know, some people are technicians, some people are artists, you know, you can
craftsmen.
Craftsmen, yeah. You know, so it's very different. So
you
I don't
know, you know
say,
the difference? You know the difference?
What's the difference?
An artist does it for himself, a craftsman does it for everybody else.
Maybe, yeah, partially. But like also, you know, just like there's different levels of everything. But right. for myself,
right.
I'm more comfortable playing my instrument than I am speaking. But that's because I practice 8 hours a day every day since I was, you know, 3 years old. So it depends, I think, your personal relationship with the instrument.
Right, but I'm sure when you play, I bet it's just this bond with you and your instrument that's unlike
again,
anything.
Not to sound so new agey, but there is no separation between myself and the music, you know? So it's
an
one,
extension of
you know?
your brain.
Yeah.
And you're not going to get that from an iPad.
Yeah.
No.
No. I mean, actually, honestly, if you play with an iPad every day, I mean, if it becomes a part of you, I think it can be anything. You know, a piece of wood with, you know, metal and
except there's a vibration. There's right. actually a...
Yeah. Well, I guess if they put a vibrating feature on
there is
iPad.
A feature.
Yeah.
That's a whole different thing.
That's a whole different
thing. It's a iPad.
That podcast starts a little bit later.
Yeah. Sorry.
Podcast after dark.
Yeah. Well, you know, Mike, the thing about it is that it's this... the whole thing with acoustic music and, you know, people making music for other people is that there's this nonverbal connection. There's this nonverbal communication that
right.
happens that, you know, that does, that, that's the only way it happens. It's a gift that we as human people, as human beings have, I think. You know, it's the one thing that we do that is just, it's beyond nature, even.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And the other thing, too, is from an audience perspective, I love looking at watching performances of people that are just masters of their craft and just really know how to play it and just can really bring it no matter what it is, you know, even if it's the guy in the subway over in New York who's playing his violin, but he's just playing his heart out. I mean, there's something cool about looking at somebody perform and really bond with their instrument and really perform.
And you know, I think that there's two sides to that, and that is the masters of their instruments who can just, you know, transcend what they're thinking. And then there's to people who aren't masters. I mean, you look at a lot of the 60s music, and they were barely musicians. But for whatever it was, they were, I mean, Bob Dylan was not a great singer. But somehow when he sung his songs, it radiated what he was thinking and what he was trying to portray.
Mick Jagger, Neil Young.
Yeah, I mean, he was going on and on. And they weren't necessarily great players. So I think that's what you're talking about, the artist.
Well, the artist is more of a heart thing, you know. Technical prowess does not equal artistry.
Absolutely.
No, that's
absolutely
true.
That's what I'm kind of saying, is that some people were necessarily not great technicians.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But they were just great artists.
If you do both, then you're really
well,
a
well, I was
going
to say, that's
you know,
when the real magic happens.
Yeah, and you look good, and you do this, and you do, you know, then it's like a combination of stuff.
Like you.
Oh, no.
I'm looking at the website right now. Let me ask you, let's just go back a little bit about talking about your rehearsal. I mean, you still practice and you're still dedicated to that. What do you do, you know, nowadays? I'm sure there's people out there thinking, wow, she still practices? I mean, everybody has to practice, but what is a you know, what's your...
What's your regimen? What do you do?
Well, I mean, it's not. I don't practice for as many hours as I used to.
Right.
One, because my parents aren't forcing me to. Two, because I'm also in the real world now, you know, and it's all about balance. So I do a lot of business stuff. You know, I like edit all my videos. I do recordings. I work, do sessions. I play concerts. So all in all, what I practice, like right now, I'm only practicing the Dvorak Cello Concerto because I have a 1-month tour with six concerts playing that next month. So I have no choice because I got to play it. So usually I only practice classical stuff usually. And I just practice whatever for whatever concerts are coming up. You know, I don't know if that makes any sense.
Let's roll back time a little bit.
Okay.
When you were a student.
Yes.
And I'm not talking about a young student, but a middle-aged
like
student.
Like in college.
Yeah, college, uh-huh. High school.
Okay.
What was your regimen like?
In high school, practice maybe 6 to 8 hours a day, you know. And,
So after school?
Before and after.
Were there certain exercises that you always did?
You know, I always, even my professor at USC thought it was strange. I never did technical exercises,
scales.
You know, barely. I didn't like scales. I refused to do etudes, you know, obviously in my case, everyone's different. It didn't really matter. You know, for me, I learned the technical stuff from the music I was playing because to me, it seemed a little bit of a roundabout way. So in order to be able to play this piece, you should learn these etudes. Well, no, why don't you just stop wasting time and learn the piece, you know, and you can learn the technical aspects as you're doing that. It might be a little bit different if you're a jazz musician.
Right.
You need to learn how to play all the different skills and all the different modes, you know, so you're able to improvise immediately. That's different. But for the classical applications, you know, where classical music is very regimented, you play it this way, you play these notes, you don't, you know, make up whatever you feel like playing, then it doesn't really apply.
Was there something you played every day?
What is something I play every day?
Was there something that you play every day or played every day? Is there something that you play every day now just as a warm-up or something?
No, I you know, because I've been performing professionally since I was 9, you know, so I was always preparing for either a concert or, you know, a competition. I don't really like competitions, but anyway.
Gotta do them sometimes.
Yeah, so it's always a specific purpose. Now when I, for example, when I write my own music,
right.
I write kind of like cinematic new age. I don't know what you categorize it as, but, you know, I'll just sit down. I write everything stream of consciousness, so I don't plan anything out. I just push record and I play. And that's, I guess it's kind of like practicing because you're playing. But to me, practice is training your body to become the machine to be able to express what you need to express without even thinking about it anymore. You know, when I step on stage and I play a concerto for 40 minutes, I don't think once. And if I'm thinking about technically what's coming next or my memory, then it means it's not prepared enough. It needs to be so ingrained into your being that it's completely awesome. Subconscious.
When you play
know?
Your music, do you write it first or do you improvise?
For what? Which, like, my music.
Because you just said that I play my music.
I never write it. So it's always, it's a direct, you know. And that's an important, like, just like when you're improvising, if you're limited because you can't play 30-second notes at, you know, 200 BPM or something because you didn't practice enough, then you're kind of screwed because you were limited by what you can do physically.
There's a lot of classical musicians.
You're not necessarily screwed.
Well,
your music won't include 30-second
notes. No, you're right.
Exactly.
No, that's right.
But it expands your vocabulary.
Yeah. That's when you turn smoke on the water. Three questions.
No, and I'm not, you know, my music is not necessarily very notey. Like, it's being able to have the things at your resources, you know, and then to do whatever you want to do.
It's very important, and it's funny. A lot of things you're saying, I have parallels, and I started classical piano when I was 3, and I've said since I was like 8 years old that I would rather play than talk. Like at a party, if there's a piano, please God let there be a piano so I can just sit and do that because everybody loves it and then you don't have to think of anything to say. I really like it. But the thing I learned early on, because I was always a really technical player, especially as a kid. I wanted the 30-second notes, you know, as fast as they could possibly be. And it wasn't until my late teens that I actually discovered the word emotion. Because up until then, everything was a race. And that's just, as a young boy, that's just the way I was.
Of course, it's natural. You can't fake emotion if you've never felt.
Definitely, you know, and it takes a while. So. But it's very important, and especially like parents who have kids who want to be musicians and stuff, and young people listening, if there are any. Mike will have to tell me. It's very important in the early years to build that dexterity and get your fingers or whatever body parts you're using to play used to the idea of playing. And you're basically building a toolkit and a palette that you can use later. But you've got to – and classical, there's nothing like classical for building those techniques. I mean, every style of music has its merits, but there's something about classical. It's regimented. There's a right and a wrong answer to what you're playing. And it's very important, especially at an early age, to get some of that stuff into your brain. It'll make you a better player later, even if you never end up playing classical. I mean,
it depends on the instrument, but sure.
To develop muscle memory, you need all 12 notes.
And I would say it does not depend on the instrument. I would say that's just a human thing.
I don't know. On the guitar side, I think I disagree. I think jazz is a better way to start than classical guitar.
I'm not talking about the idiom of music. I'm talking about that you need
muscle memory. You've got
to build that dexterity because once you have it as a kid, you will always retain some degree of it, even if you're not practicing enough. Mm-hmm. But I'm going through that right now. Well, it's very hard to develop that for the first time later. It's easier to get it back.
You know, when you're young, you can learn. You know, if you practice shooting hoops for 10 hours a day, you're going to be a really good basketball player.
Well, it's funny that you should say that.
I would still be a terrible basketball player.
I was teaching, mm-hmm. one of the things that I always said to young saxophone players was. It's an athletic exercise. You're training your body just like a football player or a basketball player trains their body to.
When you switch from a different size of the cello,
yeah,
do you automatically adjust the?
You mean like when I was growing up?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, when you were growing up, you went from one third.
Well,
to
I mean,
three, four,
I moved to full size pretty early on, you know, just to get used to it. But I don't know. I also have perfect pitch, so I play by ear sometimes also. So
that's terrible. I'm sorry.
What inspired you from being a traditional classical musician? Then you said, "Look, metal." Or alternative ways of using your instrument?
Well, you know, both my parents, they're classical musicians. My father's a cellist. My mother plays violin. Very romantic, you know. They've been together since they were like 19, 20 years old. And they're still together. And they still kiss and stuff. So it's good. But anyway, you know, when I started music, I didn't have a choice. I was forced into it, like most Asians. But seriously, like, you know, you don't have a choice. You're practicing, you know, or else. So I went to college. I was playing classical music, but back when I was younger, I was sneaking in records. I only managed to sneak in 3 CDs. One was Marilyn Manson, Antichrist Superstar. Loved it. And then Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction, because my best friend, Tina, her name is also Tina. She had a copy of it. It was a tape. So I had that. And then Daft Punk. I don't know how I got that. Dark electronica.
Awesome,
you know?
Choice, though.
Yes. Yeah. So, but that's kind of strange because that was my entire musical, like all I knew was classical and those 3 things, and sometimes the radio, but I had a very, very, very closed childhood, very sheltered, you know. So I've always been attracted to dark things, dark men, dark music, you know, just dark in general, dark chocolate. So then after I went to USC, honestly, I was actually dating a metal guitar player, and I went to a show at the Key Club. It was my first time in a club seeing metal live, and no, I mean, it wasn't that great. I'm sure he's not listening, but it wasn't that great. But just the raw, like, you know, in classical music, there's a way to express yourself, but it's like a completely different. For me, it's more ethereal. It's more, you know, heart, soul, mind. And I mean, of course, you can have that in other genres of music also. But just like some languages are a little bit more adept to communicating a certain feeling or a certain, I don't know, a certain thing, you know, I felt the metal was more like my inner beast, animal, wild woman could come out more, you know? So that's how it happened.
Nice.
Very nice.
So how often do you play live as far as how often do you use your electronic rig lab?
A lot. You know, it depends. It varies weekly. But like this week I have 4 shows. So, you know. It just depends what I'm hired for. I mean, I do music full time. I play my own music. I play other people's music, you know. So this week I'm playing electric cello Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and the classical cello on Thursday.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, and where are you playing Friday, Saturday, Sunday?
I'm actually playing with it's my first time working with them, the LA Rock Opera.
Oh, okay.
We haven't started rehearsals yet, but that's tomorrow night. And then on Thursday, I'm doing a showcase with the artist who got signed to Disney. They have a new Disney Pearl. It's like an adult contemporary label. So the classical crossover.
Wow.
But very nice, you know?
Nice.
Yeah.
I guess the trick is to just like not show up at a gig with the wrong instrument. Like,
that's right.
Show up at the Disney concert hall with the electric cello and all the amps and everything.
Yeah. Dressed in leather.
They'd be a little freaked out. that would make for good video.
This is kind of random, but I found the people who aren't, you know, in the very closed classical scene are more open-minded to classical music rather than the other way around.
Definitely.
I have to say that I've lost like couple concerts, you know. I'm not going to say which orchestras, but after they, you know, I mean, they heard my playing, my manager would send them recordings, and then they saw my website, which is not by any means pornographic or anything at all. I mean, it's just artistic, you know.
And, absolutely.
And I'm not wearing, you know, a turtleneck sweater and, you know, whatever. But
there's such snobbery though in that part of the music industry. It's amazing.
I mean, it happens everywhere in life in general, and people are very judgmental. But I think it's, you know, I don't know what that had to do with
but
anything.
But my first memory of people, you know, talking about, oh, this is not music, was actually with a cellist when I was at my only year at the conservatory when I was 11.
Uh-huh.
I had this discussion over records of Berio and Nono, you know, the contemporary music at the time.
Yeah.
And this cellist walked into the room and said, what are you listening? Well, this is music from... Ah, this is just noise. It's not music. Mm-hmm. What we learn here, it's music. I said, well, if you say so.
That's the first sign that you should not listen to someone, is if they say something like
Exactly. But, you know, it's my first memory of someone, you know, and well, it comes from the classical world.
Yeah, music or art. You can argue what's art. If you throw a banana against the wall, is that art? I mean, everything's art. It's but it, is it good or bad, or do people relate to it, you know?
You know, I do have to tell you one funny thing. When I was a teenager, I was studying classical piano. Actually, I guess it was a little after because I met Stevie Wonder when I was 21, I guess, and moved out here to work with him at 22. So I guess I was 21, 22 when this happened. I'd had a classical teacher through my later teenage years and into the early 20s. And he was an older guy, but classical piano was his entire life. I mean, I think he lived in a bubble where there was only classical piano and food somehow. And he was a nutty guy, but he was a great teacher. And he found out, or I was trying to explain to him, that I had met these people who were going to introduce me to an artist named Stevie Wonder, and there's a chance I might work with him. And listening to Stevie was my guilty pleasure since I was a little tiny kid. So for me, this was a dream come true. And he later, I found out, told the story that I had moved to California to work with a conductor named Stephen Wonder. And he was telling the story like I had gone out to be a soloist for an orchestra conducted by Stephen Wonder. That was the only way he could even process what was going on. And I just thought that was so funny.
So cool.
That's adorable.
It's true. Yeah. It was pretty funny.
Well, as you can tell... just from your stories, and I could just listen to you talk about your playing and your dedication to your instrument, that, you know, it's, I think if you really want to be a good musician, be a musician, you know, don't try to find it in a plug-in, don't try to find it in a piece of software, pick up an instrument, whatever that instrument is, and just play it and just learn it and just be dedicated. And I will say that the best... really anything that I've ever worked with in the musical field, the best mixer or engineer or producers are usually really good musicians too.
Oh, you know, best, you will, if you're a real musician, you will use the software better than a non-musician.
Right.
It's just, there's no other way around.
Yeah.
It's just true.
I don't think the software, you know, stops you from being a real
a
good musician.
No.
It's
a tool.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny that even you were saying that one of the things I've noticed, because I obviously, with what I do, I deal with a lot of picture editors. And I can tell the people who have a musical background who don't.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
Because it's weird when you tell a story with picture. There has to be a pace.
Yep.
It has to go someplace. It has to speed up and slow down. And when you look at the rhythm of a picture cut, you automatically know. So when you work with some of the great picture cutters, as a sound designer, I love it. Because then the things that I could shape and do against the rhythm of the track is all there. And when it's weird. And then when you work with people who aren't musicians sometimes, they have a very odd sense of time.
It makes your work more difficult.
Oh, it's terrible.
Because you cannot create the structure.
And the pace and scene. And
right.
It doesn't always flow that well.
Yep.
And it doesn't accelerate and slow down and do all these things. And when you do find people that have a musical sense to them.
It's like working with somebody... You're playing in an even time signature, and they're playing in an odd one.
Well, it's playing with someone who doesn't have any rhythm.
Yeah.
Right.
Then you kind of go, oh gosh. You know, because you're sitting there watching the cut, and you're like, well, that's a couple frames off, and that's...
Yeah, like, that's...
And,
I
and then you're sitting there kind of going like, the scene's not working.
You know,
right.
The cuts, either they're cutting like, cut, 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 straight people what they're doing until we find people who don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you go, why isn't this working?
Right.
I call it, in the sessions that I do, I call it the editor, whether he can dance or can't dance.
Yeah.
You know? Whether he has rhythm. Yeah. Oh, that editor can dance, that can't dance. So if they're behind us and we're talking or we're making a joke and making fun of him, you know, we can just say whether or not he can dance.
It's like working with a percussion player that's not quite there. Yeah. You lay down a beat and you're like, you know, I can't even do it badly. Because it's just too ingrained.
That's true.
You know.
Hey, we got to wrap it up because we're actually running long. Hey, who would have thought?
So this is, what, the 103rd time we've run long? Is that true?
That's true. But one thing I do want to say, too, is if you're a parent out there and you want to encourage your kids to keep practicing, encourage your kids to keep practicing. It's, you know, they may not want to.
They won't. Bribing works.
Whatever you need to. Well,
I think
not
terror,
whatever,
you know.
Terror, bribery, yes.
Encourage them to go to Tina's website.
No, that's true, too. Absolutely. Look at a couple of success stories in yours in particular.
I've actually had some, you know, parents write to me on Facebook asking me to write to their kid to make them practice, you know. And when I can, I do.
Nice.
And they're like,
wow.
Thank you, you know.
You heard that here. She will write them.
By the way, I can tell you one bribery thing that actually worked on me and some of my siblings that my father came up with was a thing called the 100-hour club.
What?
And the 100-hour club was once you logged 100 hours of practicing, there was a prize of some sort. For me personally, I'll never forget it because my mine was a Wurlitzer electric piano, which back then was not all that cool, but now it's like total collector's
item. Yeah.
But and you still have it.
I do. It's on the East Coast, unfortunately. I'll get it out there one of these years. But the idea is if you set a goal, it has to be a manageable chunk because a kid can't understand, well, I know you're only 8, but do this now because when you're 20, you're going to be so glad I'm forcing you to do it now. You got to make it a measurable goal. And for us, 100 hours, it takes a while to practice 100 hours, especially if you're a normal kid. Well, maybe not for Tina. That's like, what, 4 days?
I didn't have a choice. And I know it's a very extreme way of going about things.
Do you feel, interesting. Do you feel you missed out on things that you wish you would have?
Of course I missed out on things, but the payoff, anything, you know, the greater the sacrifice, the payoff now.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know,
it's the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Is that what I read a book about?
Yeah.
You know, if you
it's Malcolm Gladwell.
You do anything for that much, you know, that much time, and
except the only problem is if you tell your kid at 10,000 hours you get a prize, you know.
Yeah, it's not gonna work. Yeah.
I guess I was lying because my dad says you gotta study piano, you gotta buy me a synth. Okay, which one do you want?
Wow.
No, because you got a piano already. So
I was bribed with a crybaby. I just went. I was a guitar player. And they go, keep practicing.
Or you can say, if you don't practice for 8 hours a day, you won't eat anything.
That works, too.
Ouch, that works hardcore.
Yeah, tiger hardcore.
Well, also, I can't imagine having two parents who are professional musicians. I mean, because even beyond whatever the normal cultural pressure would be, the idea that that's just all that's eaten and breathed and slept in the house, that's really intense.
Well, you know, I'm always honest, and I'm not going to lie. It's just, it's like, for me personally, it's a very extreme example. You know, not all parents are going to be able to you know, do what my parents did to, you know.
That's true, but as a parent, though, you have to, you know, you have to prod them because kids
at
that
age something,
will not, if it's a choice between playing outside and practicing, they will not want to practice.
Well, you know what else? There's a distinction. I used to love to play the piano. I just hated practicing. Mm-hmm. And they're very different. When you're playing, you're not learning.
Absolutely.
It's like when you're talking, you're not listening. It's
same
kind
me.
Of thing.
Same for me.
Playing is not the same. Playing's important because that's where you feel the joy. Mm-hmm. But practicing, doing something that's hard, that you have to actually slow down to learn it,
Means
pleasurable. You're growing. No, it shouldn't. If it's too
horrible.
Pleasurable, it means you're not learning.
Yeah.
And, you know, another thing, too, is if your kid's not wanting to practice or if you're having a hard time yourself practicing, one thing that, you know, you can learn from Tina is there's other ways to practice, you know. There's other ways to approach
another
it.
Another thing to say, if they don't like practicing, you might consider a different instrument. Because sometimes, you know, your parents, maybe they're focused on a specific instrument. It's not your instrument. you might be great with something else. So it's a good idea to keep the horizons a little open.
And
you know?
Not just that, but it's okay. In our family, everybody had one instrument. And I learned way later in life that you were allowed to play more than one. Like, I was all piano. I wish I'd learned guitar. It would be serving me well now.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with trying multiple instruments because you're going to eventually settle into what's right for you
as an instrument. If you're really a musician, I really believe that the artistry of being a musician is genetic.
It is.
My father was a jazz musician, a tremendous trumpet player. His mother was a concert violinist. My son has the gene, but he is not a practicer. But he taught himself in fifth grade to play the oboe.
Huh. Wow.
And then he taught himself 1 year later how to play the bass. Mm-hmm. Wow. How to play the upright bass.
Right, right.
Wow.
So
it is a gene.
There's a gene.
I agree that can happen, but I also think, you know, the whole nature versus nurture, not necessarily. I mean, I know great musicians who don't have any family members that play music.
Sure.
Or hate it. You know?
Sure.
Like my dad, another extreme story, you know, he was in communist China right by the border of Russia, and he would sneak out in the middle of the night at like midnight after his parents fell asleep in the snow to practice the erhu. He played erhu, you know, the Chinese instrument. Because his parents like literally hated music so much that they wouldn't let him play.
Wow.
So, I mean, I didn't do that. I was forced to, but it was opposite.
But
you
also have perfect pitch. But that doesn't mean
that's not genetic. My parents, nobody in my family has perfect pitch.
No, but what I'm saying is if you have a child that has perfect pitch or somebody who has that little spark, then the question is, do you want to grow it? Because it's not saying that you can't be a good musician without it, but when you see somebody has a spark.
You know what I really think, like, for me, when I became not a technician and a musician, after I felt love and heartbreak, and it's like the emotional stuff. If you never grow as a person, so.
I'll also say, of me and my five siblings, there are six of us total, and two of us have perfect pitch. I have it, and one of my sisters has it. And she was, growing up, she also played piano. And she was really, really good, but like perfect pitch is a genetic thing, I assume, because it's not something you can learn. Relative pitch you learn. And the only difference between perfect pitch and relative pitch is with perfect pitch, you can pull a note out of the air. You know, somebody says, give me an A, and you give them an A.
Yeah.
But with relative pitch, if someone gives you an A, you can then find everything else. And in the real world, that's really all that matters. Like Stevie has relative pitch. He doesn't have perfect pitch. Perfect pitch is really more like a parlor trick when it comes to actually playing an instrument. Those things are so much less important than having the dexterity and having the emotional connection with the instrument and all that stuff. It's a head start because, you know, you can see a G on a page and tell that you're playing a G because you know what a G sounds like. So maybe that saves you a little bit of time. But that's nothing compared to really connecting with the instrument and learning how to convey an emotion with it. It's just, it's great when it all lines up. Like for Tina, she has those natural abilities, and she had the parents who drove her to it originally, and she had the love for it, and the ability to communicate with it. So that's like a perfect storm of a bunch of things coming together.
With your perfect pitch, can you also get clusters of notes? I had a friend of mine in Italy.
Yeah, we used to teach.
Yeah, I can.
I used to play chords. To go, give me the chord.
For me personally, you can take your hands in a clump and just set them down. I'll tell you.
Well, this friend of mine.
But that's a parlor trick. That's a parlor trick.
My first friend, we did that. He's like, give me a chord. I play these like really, really tight cluster chords, and he's like, yeah, that's in third inversion.
But this friend of mine, I was putting my arm on the piano over the phone, and he was telling me from the first to the last.
You know that in my early years, like I used to do that when I was like five.
Right.
And that was the family party trick. I mean, right, after dinner, it was always let's go in the living room and try to stump Rob.
Right.
And you know what? And that's a genetic thing.
Right.
I'm also
right.
profoundly colorblind. So, you know, you lose one sense and others get heightened. And I always thought that was my trade-off because I could always tell what notes were playing. And the way I described it is like if I hear an orchestra playing or if I hear music, I sort of see a transcription.
Right. Right.
So I always know what notes everybody's playing. But visually, my eyes are just horrible, not just blurriness, but I don't see colors right. I have real deficiencies there. And I always just kind of thought that as a kid when I was developing, because I wasn't taking in all the colors of the world, I was just taking in more stuff.
It could be.
Audibly.
Wow. You know, Quincy Jones sees color in music, and
some
so does Bruce Swindeen.
Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, there's a whole brain thing with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's pretty cool. It's a visual pattern.
Did you hear about the guy who got hit in the head by a baseball, and he could, like, calculate I don't know what it was. One of those savant things, but it was actually it happened after an accident, which means, you know, the wiring in the brain.
It means it's there.
Maybe if I hit you hard enough. You
I was going to say one thing that's great about going back to the musician thing, like, and then I know we got to wrap this up.
We got
to
wrap it up. But go ahead.
Sorry. But you know, because I used to play a lot of guitar, and then I stopped playing, and I'm getting back into it a lot. And what's great is there's a lot of great techniques and stylizations that I've been seeing. And my technique, I could play. I mean, and my fingers know what to do, but I'm trying to figure out the new styles. And as a kid, I never had YouTube. So now that I see YouTube,
I'm
sitting there because I was tinkering around, bought some amps, bought some stuff, and then I went, oh, I can do that. Mm-hmm. Oh, I can do that. Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that. Oh, I like what he's doing. Yeah. And all of a sudden, I started going and started just picking up riffs.
Yeah. That's how I learned the electric cello. I watched, you know, all the shredders, Steve Vai, Yngwie Malmsteen. I had never heard of any of them before. So that's how I learned. Because there's nobody to teach you.
But what's great is you can see the fingering.
Okay, we got to wrap it up.
You know. Okay.
He's making faces over there.
Mike, you still there?
His fist in the air.
No, I'm still here, but...
You're a rooster crow in
the
background.
This is turning into 103 and 104.
Yes, we're now 104.
All right, it starts here. Actually, the funny thing is there was so much more I wanted to talk about. We just didn't get to it.
Well, that happens.
We're just going to have to bring Tina back and join us again.
All right.
Because I wanted to talk about recording instruments, and I wanted to talk about, you know, dealing with session musicians and all kinds of stuff. That's
how you should treat them.
That's right.
No, we didn't want to talk about that.
and I promise I'll have coffee next time.
Thank you. Right. Thank you. That was a hint. I'm glad you got it.
But gourmet coffee, that is.
Tina, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you. Thanks
for having
me.
Thank you.
Just enlightening us. And like I said, you should check out her website. And is there anything you want to plug, anything that you're going to be involved with? Or you want to talk about anything? Any tours coming up where people can come see you? Or?
I actually have a very big tour coming up, but I can't talk about it yet due to contractual things, but very soon. So just keep updated on my website. You can see me on Facebook, facebook.com/TinaGuoMusic, TinaGuo Music. That's my official Facebook.
That's Guo, like Guo, in
Guo. Like Guo.
And do you have any, are you on iTunes? Is there any?
I just got a new distribution deal, so I had to pull everything off and then have it resubmitted, but soon. And I have a new record coming out called The Journey, and it's actually, sums up my entire musical life so far. So it starts out classical, and it goes all the way through like new age and cinematic music, all the way to industrial metal. So I play in every style. It's released on my own label, of course, because it's, you know, a little crazy for a
normal release. I was going to say, that would be a hard sell to a label, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but I think
that's great.
Yeah, so it'll be available on iTunes and in stores, but it'll probably next month.
Great. Well, we'll keep looking.
Thank you
for that. And also, yeah, I recommend people go over and check out her website and her Facebook page
and YouTube videos. Lots of videos.
YouTube,
tons of videos.
You know, so we'll link to one on the podcast so that just let me know which one that you want to have us post. Rob, you working on anything?
I am. Actually, that's one of the reasons Michael Bard is here. We're working on something together. I've talked about Google stuff in the past, and we've done some things for Google, and I think I gave you a link to put on the website for the last Google project we did together.
We did.
And so we're doing a few new things together, and it's pretty cool stuff.
Nice.
I don't know if you know this, but Google has some innovative ideas.
Wait, who are they again?
And we're actually also embarking on some music projects, which I'll be able to talk about soon, but sort of throwback to the old days. And it's some traditional recording and mixing, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
Nice. Diego, how about yourself?
I keep it simple. There's a few things I'm working on I can't really talk about, but I'm working on a film, and it's really cool. And that's all I have to say.
Tina, this is pretty much standard.
Yeah, everybody. Oh, sorry.
Everybody's working on
stuff. I'm top secret.
Working on a lot of stuff, and it's all really cool.
Was that yours?
That's mine.
Scott, what about you?
Hello! No, so, I am finishing up Green Lantern, and I've got about another couple weeks on that, and that's a lot of fun. That should be coming to a theater near you this summer. And
you can say that with the right voice, though.
Coming to a theater near you! Some great stuff. What I've loved is it's allowed me to branch out and do things and experiment with toys that I've always wanted to experiment with. And so the sound design is cool. finishing up a mix for a video game, which I can't talk about.
Of course.
And the coolest thing is, which we could talk about as time goes on, but I can't say what it is. But I'm on a project, on a movie, that I may spend on and off a year and a half with the sound. And it's hopefully going to allow me to do whatever my imagination comes up with.
Especially a lot of cello and electric cello.
Oh! Yes. Now you're talking.
Look at that. That was awesome. That was awesome.
So, for me, it's kind of that's kind of one of my dreams. And it's with a client that I just love to death. And I think we're at the very beginning of a journey that should be pretty amazing.
Nice. Bobby, how about you?
I've been busier than ever. Which is good, thankfully. I just finished up the second edition for Music 3.0, Survival Guide for Making Music in the Internet Age. I'm in pre-production for an album I'm producing. Tomorrow I'm lecturing at CSU Dominguez Hills. On Friday and Saturday, I'm giving a presentation at the ASCAP event that's coming up, and I'm moderating a panel. And that's this week.
That sounds like enough.
Yeah.
So we're going to actually do something.
Yeah.
Cut so lazy.
How about you, Mike?
Working on a bunch of stuff that I cannot talk about. Pretty much it. Just did, nope. I just want to tell people that are listening, a lot of times that we say we can't talk about it, we literally can't because all of us sign either NDA agreements. And basically what that's for is so that if we release any information here, whatever client or company that we're doing the work for, they want to release it. They want to have the first dibs as to even let you know that the project exists.
And they're paying for that privilege. Yeah. So it's only fair.
That's right. And then the reason why we even talk about it is just so you guys know that at least we're working. And then we'll come back after it gets released and say, hey, we did this and this.
Like we always do that.
Yeah, like I did with the Prey 2 teaser and like Scott's done with some of his movies and things like that. And the only reason why I mentioned this is because I did get an email from a listener saying, why do you guys even talk about the stuff that you guys can't talk about?
That you guys can't talk about.
I know.
It's all about the tease.
I always try to think of something can talk about, but it's hard. Generally, the bigger and better a project is, the less you can talk about it before it's done.
Oh, I did pizza this week.
You said what?
I did pizza.
Pizza?
Pizza.
Yeah. Pizza. The question is, what kind?
Which sounds did you get?
You did a pizza. That's
you so did good. The sounds of pizza?
No, I actually did that pizza.
All right, before we go,
there's
a couple of business things that we got to take care of really quick. On the last podcast, we had our new sponsor, API, which is sponsoring the podcast, gave us some swag to give out. I said, you had to write in on why you like the Audio Nowcast, and I'd pick a...
Did we get two of them?
We got three of them.
We got
more than that. But I did pick the two finalists, and even though I haven't sent them to you guys yet, but I just want to congratulate two people. Number one, Benjamin Simmons, and I'm just going to read the first part of his podcast letter. It says, hi, been catching up on the podcast over the last half year. Right there, he won. Because it took us 5 years to do all these podcasts, and the fact that this guy is starting from zero and going through all 102 shows, he just deserves it. Some swag. So, the other people are Robert and Teresa Weber, and we're going to send them out some swag also. Of course, we only have one shirt, so you guys are going to have to share. And the reason why I picked him is I'd like to tell you, but I'd just be repeating what I already wrote in my blog. And then he put a link to his blog. Okay, anybody who talks about us on a blog, they deserve something.
Right.
That means that we got reposted somewhere.
Right.
So those are our two winners, and eventually you'll get your swag.
Nice.
We're going to send them out, and I'll get in touch with you on the email that you sent us the letters with. And besides that, I also want to give a shout out to Martin. Martin hurt his back, and he is in a little pain. So I just want to give a shout out to him. And I know Brandon was feeling under the weather, so I give a shout out to him. I don't know if they listen, but hey, my conscience is clear.
It's good.
Other than that, if you have any comments or questions, you can reach us on Facebook, or you can catch us on our email at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And you know what, Bobby? Next time, because we're not gonna talk about this right now, or else we'll go on for another hour, but I want to bring up Rebecca Black and some of the stuff you were telling us about that, because you missed that conversation.
Yeah.
And two things happened. Number one, I knew you'd have something good to say. And number two, Rob was so right on so many things, as you see the story evolve. Yeah, as you see the story evolve.
At some point, you're going to start to listen to me, Mike. Why do you think I'm showing up for every single one of these things?
I never disagree with you. I'm just saying. As a matter of fact, I was trying to find something when you were right, and hey, Rob was right.
You still sound a little surprised.
That's okay. That's okay. All right. Well, once again, thanks, Tina, for joining us. And for myself and all the guys, thank you for listening, and we'll see you.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.